How good it is for brothers and sisters to dwell together in unity. This past month, I have been to two funerals and a wedding. I'd love to be able to say four weddings and a funeral, but for those of you familiar with that movie, but no, it's been two funerals and a wedding. The first funeral was a funeral in Toronto. I had the honor of officiating for a fine man. Good funeral, but what stood out was the cooperation between his children. Two sons and a daughter, all very different in personality, but coming together, planning together, and showing the value and the benefits of unity. Just a couple of weeks ago, had the pleasure of officiating a wedding. Many of you know Anu, and Anu was married, and lots of highlights to that weekend, but to me it was seeing the level of cooperation and the love and the unity with that family literally spread out around the globe. And to spend a little bit of time at one point with Anu and her brother and sister-in-law from Australia, and I thought, wow, the bond of family love is a very powerful thing. The other funeral I attended was as well for a very fine woman. It was very obvious to all of us that her children don't get along. Very sad, actually quite heartbreaking. Now you need to know I'm thinking about and praying for that family because I'm an optimist and I believe that the Lord can bring about restoration. But how good and pleasant it is for brothers and sisters to dwell together in unity. Just before my dad died, and he was one who gave me a lot of advice. Dad said to the four of us, I want to make sure that you guys get along. That was the two words, and they motivate me these days as I'm doing executor work for my parents' estate, and I'm going, that's what Mom and Dad would want. Get along. Those of you who are parents with children, my guess is that's one of your great desires, that they get along. I wonder how Isaac felt because he knew there was great tension between his sons Jacob and Esau. I wonder if he was holding out to that dream that they might one day get along. Hey, conflict is everywhere. I don't have the time this morning to break down theories around conflict. In fact, there's great debate even to how you define conflict. I mean, a lot of what gets called conflict are actually just problems that are differences of opinion, differences of preference, different perspectives. And they can be, and they should be sorted out. In fact, I would argue some of these differences are very healthy. There's aspects of problems in a marriage or in any relationship that are good and healthy. I'm more concerned when a couple says to me, we never disagree. We never see things differently. That to me is not a sign of a healthy relationship. But conflict comes when there's feelings that are a lot more intense. There's a crossing of the line. There's feelings of defensiveness. There's feelings that are quite drastic. So maybe it is a case where a typical problem could become much more escalated, a whole different level of severity. Now, some of our conflicts are straightforward. They come because someone has wronged another. That's a pretty obvious conflict. There are other conflicts that are way more complicated. And I'm aware that for some of you, you're thinking, John, you need to know that some of my personal conflicts with others are very, very complicated. I get that. Sometimes it's not clear who did wrong and who did right. Is there a sense where there's wrongs coming from both directions? I think of a case recently I'm aware of where two close friends, Jim and Joe, grew up together, great friends, but Jim was upset because a year ago his mom died and Joe didn't show up for the funeral. Jim feels that Joe was very uncaring, very unloving. How could he not show up for the funeral? But Joe feels misunderstood because, as he explained to Jim, he had a business trip that took him across the ocean, and he feels misunderstood, that Jim just doesn't get that while he wanted to be there, he couldn't be there. Well, what you've got now is a conflict, because for the last year, those guys have not connected or even spoken to each other. That's how conflicts get created. That's how conflicts happen in life. So we want to deal this morning with conflicts, and whether it's in marriage, and these days there seems to be an epidemic of conflict in marriage, whether it's conflict involving siblings, maybe some of you that touches a sore point. You're going, no, I don't get along with one of my brothers or one of my sisters. It can be conflict in parenting, maybe an issue you have with a parent, or maybe an issue a parent has with a child. There's conflicts between neighbors. Some of us know that too well. Some of you may be dealing with a conflict at work. And as you sit here this morning, it consumes your thoughts. It is always on your mind that there's someone that you're in conflict with. And believe it or not, there can even be conflict between church members. I've called this morning's message very simply, getting along. Last week, we looked at Genesis 32. There were two big ideas. First of all, captured in Jacob's prayer of, I need help. There's this encounter coming up with my brother Esau, we don't get along, and God, it's beyond me. I can't figure it out. I need help. And then in that wrestling match, and many of you gave great feedback to that over the last few days, where Jacob essentially says, Lord, I need you. I get it. I can't do life on my own. I need you. And this morning, as we look at this matter of getting along, I want to make sure we don't lose the context. In Genesis 28, Jacob is converted, but as we move along, there's what we call sanctification or change or growth or maturing in his experience with God. And that becomes a key part of what we'll look at. Now, if you think this morning that we're going to be looking at five easy ways to resolve conflict, you'll be disappointed. Or if you think that in one sermon we're going to deal with everything you need to know about conflict and conflict resolution, you will be discouraged. What I do want to present you with is some observations and some insights. Some of these insights may go way beyond the matter of conflict resolution, but these are truths that emerge from Genesis 33, and I hope they'll be helpful to us. So let's look at our first observation or our first insight when it comes to conflict resolution. I just want us to look at the start of chapter 33, one verse. So here's Jacob. Keep in mind the context. He's just fought all night with the mystery man, who we discovered is God himself. It's a physical fight. It's an all-out battle. And my proposal is that the end of that long evening, Jacob would have been exhausted. I don't know about you, but fighting with someone for 10 minutes could be exhausting. for 7-8 hours? I can't imagine how exhausted Jacob would have been. He has his hip dislocated. He's in obvious pain. He's prone, exhausted. But he's also exhilarated. He has had this personal one-on-one encounter with the God who created the universe. He is on a spiritual high. I'm sure he would love to have stuck around on the ground and savored all of this and soaked it in. We read these words. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. My point here is a long one because I want to capture two or three thoughts in it. Problems in life are inevitable. Conflict is real, so conflict resolution should not be avoided. Now, God had instructed Jacob earlier to go back home to Bethel. Jacob takes the initiative on his way back home to have contact with Esau. In fact, I said last week, he goes out of his way to have contact with Esau. Now remember, for those of you maybe who haven't been here, I'll tell you this too, that Esau is upset because Jacob ripped him off. Not just once, but two significant times. And when we left Jacob in Genesis 27, Esau wanted to kill Jacob. He wanted to get rid of Jacob. But what we see here is Jacob going out of his way after 20 long years to initiate this contact and maybe work towards resolution with Esau. Now, after this encounter with God, maybe Jacob thought, this will maybe be an escape from reality. I'm on a spiritual high. I don't need to deal with problems or some of these kinds of conflicts. Remember, that's the way it often was after attending summer camp. You'd be at a great teen camp, and you were on a spiritual high. It was euphoric. You'd spend nights around the campfire. You would hear testimonies. You would be mingling with other Christian young people, and you'd say, is this what heaven is like? Like, this is great. And then you'd come back home, and it usually was that first week back at school, and you realize that it really is back to reality. There were problems and issues and conflicts, and that's life. You might find on a Sunday morning, you leave going, wow, that was a great experience. I felt it was a really close encounter with God, and I'm just going to have enough momentum to get through the week and on to another great spiritual high. But often, you walk right into problems and conflict, and you have to deal with the realities of life. The paradox here is that this encounter with Esau was a long time coming, over 20 years. But there's also an element of suddenness to this confrontation. Jacob kind of looked up, and there was Esau with 400 warriors coming to meet Jacob. My bottom line on this observation is, don't be surprised. I find it somewhat alarming where Christians can go, I can't believe that I have problems or I have difficulties in life. Didn't Jesus promise in the upper room, in this life you will have many troubles? It's part and parcel of what it means to live in this world, to walk in this world. Oh, he promises resources and help, but don't be surprised when conflict comes, when there are problems that need to be dealt with. And Jacob models for us that conflict resolution, dealing with it, confronting the issue, should not be avoided. Let's look at the next couple of verses. For context, we'll look at verse 1 again. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. So Jacob divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two female servants. He put the female servants and their children in front, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph in the rear. He himself was at the rear hiding. No, he himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. This is my observation on these verses. There are some characteristics we see of a reconciler here in Genesis 33. The type of person who is a peacemaker, the kind of person who is determined to live with others in unity. I want to comment on 2 of these character qualities. The first is bravery or courage. In chapter 32, we discover that Jacob was full of fear and dread. Jacob had lived his life as a mama's boy. He was a guy who went out of his way to avoid confrontation or conflict resolution. When he heard that Esau wanted to kill him, Jacob, with his mom's encouragement, ran to his uncle Laban. He ran from his problems. He ran from conflict. But here we see in Genesis 33, Jacob has changed. He's grown. He's now willing to deal with it, and courageously. He doesn't put others in front of him. He doesn't try to hide. He doesn't run off. He likely couldn't run off with his dislocated hip. But what we see here is Jacob going out front, willing to deal with Esau up front and personal. So bravery and courage. But the second characteristic that I admire is Jacob's humility. Jacob had lived most of his life as a guy who is very conceited and arrogant. He always put a premium on doing things his way, which is why he was a schemer and a deceiver. But here we see Jacob displaying humility. You can read it very quickly that he bowed down 7 times. I've looked at the Hebrew meaning here, and this isn't 7 quick nods of the head as a courteous acknowledgement of Esau. Keep this in mind. Jacob has a dislocated hip. He's in a lot of pain. I got to tell you, having experienced what I did over the last few weeks with my knee, I cannot imagine Jacob in that condition, bowing down prostrate, not once, not twice, not 3, 4, 5 times, not even 6 times, but 7 times, poor old Jacob hits the ground as a sign of humility, back up to his feet and down again. Jacob displayed humility. There's no excuses. No Jacob saying to Esau, now let's make this clear. When I stole the birthright, when I swindled you out of the blessing, it's because I knew that God had promised our dad Isaac that it was to come to me. I was just helping God out. What was the big deal, Esau? There's no excuses. Jacob mans up. He owns up to the fact he ripped his brother off. I find it quite astounding because with what Isaac said to Jacob, here we see a reversal. Jacob knows that he and his descendants will have others like Esau and his descendants bow down to him. But this is the great reversal we see with humility. Here is Jacob and later his family bowing down before brother Esau. We see here in these verses genuine repentance. We see someone who has truly changed. I love this verse in Romans chapter 12. It fits so well with our context. Live in harmony. Get along with one another. Do not be proud. Be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Someone has said recently that one of the great endangered character qualities is humility. I'm convinced that a healthy dose of humility will do wonders in your marriage. I'm convinced that's what we need in church life. When church members show humility one to another, with your siblings, with your children, with your parents, humility is such an important factor. In Philippians chapter 2, Paul points out to Jesus as a wonderful model of humility. And the lesson for us is, don't think of yourself more highly than you should, but think of others, their concerns, their interest, their opinions. Put them even ahead of your own. If you find yourself in a conflict situation, can I encourage you to ask the question, would we be closer to conflict resolution if I displayed more humility? Let's look at our third observation. And this is a very exciting part of the Jacob Esau story. But, I love that word, but Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and choked him to death. No, that is what we would think might have happened, but no, he threw his arms around his neck and he kissed him and they wept. This is where we should have some background music. This is a dramatic moment. I get goosebumps. Do you get goosebumps when you see two brothers who had been in such awful conflict and for so long, they're embracing each other, kisses of affection, weeping together? Then Esau looked up and saw the women and children. Who are these with you? He asked. Jacob answered, they're the children God has graciously given your servant. Then the female servants and their children approached. They bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. Last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. Esau asked, what's the meaning of all these flocks and herds I met? To find favor in your eyes, my lord, he said. But Esau said, I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. No, please, said Jacob. If I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God, now that you have received me favorably. So much packed in those verses. But my point or observation is this. Surprise! Prayer works. From a human perspective, there's no way that we should have had this kind of encounter between Jacob and Esau. If we look through chapter 32, it's very obvious that Jacob could not at all figure out how he and Esau were going to be able to patch things together. But what we discovered last week is that in desperation, Jacob prayed. He prayed very specifically about this conflict between him and Esau. And remarkably, God answers this prayer. My only explanation for you is that God changed Esau's heart. Some would say, well, time heals. I think at times it can, but I think there's something much bigger at work here. And here's something, and we're going to stretch ourselves for a few moments theologically. You've got believing Jacob and unbelieving Esau, and at this moment, Esau is a real hero. And again, it's one of the many twists we see in Scripture where the so-called bad guy is actually a model for us of forgiveness. I've said this before from this platform. I think it confused the crowds greatly when Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan. Great story, isn't it? But it's a Good Samaritan. It would be like me telling a parable about the good Muslim terrorist. I'm not sure it would go over well. Some of us would go, wait a second, you've got it wrong. That's not the guy who's the good guy or the hero. But what we see here is a very important principle. Don't limit God. God can influence anyone. Psalm 2 tells us that God can influence the heart of leaders. Isn't that encouraging in these troubling days? God is God. God is not limited. And at this moment, he had changed Esau's heart and his disposition towards his brother. Esau, of all people, becomes a model of forgiveness. Sometimes, even unbelievers can do good things. Remember when we moved into our home in Ajax, and Heather was pregnant at the time. I'd had a long meeting at the church. There was a big snowfall. I pulled into our street going, I'm going to be out hours shoveling the driveway. I pulled towards our driveway, and I noticed that it had been shoveled. I thought, that Heather, 7 months pregnant, out shoveling. And Heather said, no, it wasn't me. She said, it was Eric across the street. Now, you need to know, Eric was a rough-and-tumble guy. I'm quite convinced he was not a believer in Jesus Christ. But Eric had come over and shoveled our whole driveway. And it was a big driveway. And I was so grateful and also so conflicted. I wanted to go over and say, Eric, you've got it all reversed. I'm the Christian. I'm to be the guy doing the good stuff. You're the evil sinner. You're to be the guy who just kind of ignores me. But the lesson I learned was that, follow this. I'm not trying to be heretical. Everyone's on a spiritual journey. If you push me hard, and this would likely require a lot of conversation, discussion, at the end of the day, I'm not sure what Esau's eventual spiritual status was. I know there's a couple of negative statements in Hebrews. They seem to pinpoint an earlier time in history. Wouldn't it be remarkable if we see Esau in heaven? Is it possible? Wow. God is God. And to me, the lesson here is answered prayer. Prayer works. If you have a disagreement with someone, if there's division, or if you're in conflict with a family member, I hope that you are praying about that situation. That needs to be your go-to. And you're going, but John, you don't know how difficult she is. You don't know how hard-hearted he is. This isn't just a momentary thing. This has been an issue that's been there, and it's clustered, and it's messy. And I say, great, because you're not going to solve that on your own. Prayer works. If God could change Esau's heart, because Esau, believe me, was ready to kill his brother Jacob. But remarkably, beyond human explanation, God changed the heart of Esau. Prayer works. Jacob and Esau experienced reconciliation. Jacob, of course, experienced an element of safety. Pray, not only about the conflict, but as Jesus said, it's one thing to pray for your friends, pray for your enemies. Is that a go-to for you when you pray? Hey, Lord, here's the three or four people I'm not getting along with. They're at the top of my list. I need to pray for them. Because God, I believe that prayer works. Just a quick comment on verse 10. You see how Jacob links his encounter and experience with God and his experience and encounter with Esau. He's saying, when I saw the face of God, it reminds me now of seeing you, Esau. He sees this great link, which is beyond what we can imagine. That's why when Jesus is asked, what's the greatest commandment in the singular? He answers, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and link to it. You can't separate it. Love your neighbor as yourself. So to say, well, I'm really tight with God these days, but I'm not getting along with other people, and I really don't care. It's a package deal. It's linked. Love God, love others. And as you encounter God in the truest meaning of encountering God, You're inspired, you're strengthened, you're enabled to get along with others. Let's look at the next observation. Just one verse. Jacob again appealing, please accept the present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me and I have all I need. And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. This is another remarkable feature of the story. The taker becomes a giver. Jacob had lived his life being a taker. He took away the birthright. He took away the blessing. He took as much as he could from Uncle Laban. He kept taking and taking. Wealth and women and everything that came with it. But now there's a change. There's a transformation. The taker has become the giver. And it's interesting to see the importance of goodwill and generosity in this story. For Jacob, the gift is like a seal. It's a sign of reconciliation, but it's also a symbol of repentance. He has changed. He's not looking at what he's going to take away from the situation, but he's wanting to give. In chapter 32, he wants to give gifts to Esau to pacify him. Now it's gifts that are a gift of opportunity. How do we give gifts in conflict situations? It's a commitment to practice good words and good deeds. It can really take away the severity of a situation when we practice goodness. The person who has something against you, the person who looks at you negatively, when they see you genuinely doing good works and good deeds, the love and honor that come with it can be do wonders when it comes to what it means to practice reconciliation. So we see here Jacob, that willingness to give. Even after Esau said, I really don't need anything from you, it was very important for Jacob to seal it through these gifts. Can I just quickly say, make sure that you're a good receiver. There's someone who maybe has wronged you. They've worked to make it right, but they feel compelled to do good and show love and kindness to you. It's important not only to be someone who can take what God provides, but also receive from God and others what they want to give you in terms of healthy relationship. I've got two final observations. These verses could be ignored. They don't seem to have a lot to do with conflict resolution, but Esau said, well, let us be on our way. I'll accompany you. But Jacob said to him, my Lord knows that the children are tender. They must care for the ewes and cows that are nursing their young. If they are driven hard just one day, all the animals will die. So let my Lord go on ahead of his servant while I move along slowly at the pace of the flocks and herds before me and the pace of the children until I come to my Lord and Seir. Esau said, then let me leave some of my men with you. But why do that? Jacob asked. Just let me find favor in the eyes of my Lord. So that day Esau started on his way back to Seir. My observation here is what I'm calling avoiding Seir. Or a better paraphrase, when we see reconciliation at times has its limits. Now it's interesting, if we were to forward ahead to Genesis 36, the reason why Jacob and Esau didn't kind of move in together and enjoy day-to-day living as brothers is because there wasn't enough room for all their flocks. And that explanation is kind of hidden in the start of Genesis 36. I think there's another reason why Jacob was reluctant to go to Esau's home base. And that is that Jacob had concern even about Esau's lifestyle and the lifestyle of the residents of that place. And to illustrate this, let me tell you about my cousin's husband, Dan. Dan was brought up in a home, an unbelieving home, a lot of parties, a lot of lifestyle choices that weren't good. Dave was converted to Christ, is a solid believer in Christ, and gets along quite well with his family. They go to family functions, they celebrate occasions. But Dave was telling me, he said, you know, I'm really careful not to overdo it. They would love me to go right back into that lifestyle, to go to all the parties they attend, to do the kind of things they did, and I know it won't be healthy for me to go into that lifestyle. So sometimes, though I believe very much in getting along and reconciliation, reconciliation at times can have its limits. Sometimes for practical reasons, there will be some distance between you and another. And sometimes for moral or spiritual reasons, there may need to be some distance. And then let's look at the last statements in Genesis 33. I forgot this. I commend Jacob for avoiding going with Esau. What I don't like is that he lies about it. He gives a kind of a feeble excuse, and what he should have done is spoke the truth in love. He should have said to Esau, here's why I'm not going to Seir. The interesting thing is Jacob never goes to Seir, even though he gave the impression that he would soon arrive there. Sometimes with others, we just need to speak the truth in love. It's okay to say, hey, we want to get along and we want to be reconciled, but I've made some lifestyle choices and it will be good for me to ensure that I maintain those convictions. But here's where Jacob really takes a step back. I wish I could leave you with a happy ending, but this is Jacob. And you know what? Jacob is just like you and he's just like me. Sanctification at times is pretty messy because at times we can be pretty messed up. So look at what happens here. Jacob, however, went to Succoth where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock. So after all these years of living in a tent, he's finally built a house. That is why the place is called Succoth. But after Jacob came from Paddan Aram, he arrived safely at the city of Shechem. So he's on the move again, and this is in Canaan, and he camped within sight of the city. For 100 pieces of silver he bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, the plot of ground where he pitched his tent, back to the tents. There he set up an altar and called it El Elho Israel. Seems kind of straightforward. There's a problem. God had called Jacob to go home and to go to Bethel. Shechem is close to Bethel. Take a look at your Bible map this afternoon. You're going to see it's really, 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 really close, but it's not Bethel. So my point here with Jacob's step backwards is watch out for complacency and watch out for compromise. Jacob's on a roll. He has had this great encounter with God. He's now had this encounter with Esau that has gone so well, and it's like he drops his guard. And instead of full obedience, going to Bethel, he settles for something that is close to Bethel. It's what we call partial obedience. And the problem with partial obedience is it's very, very dangerous. This partial obedience, we're going to discover next week, will endanger Jacob and his family. You read ahead in Genesis 34, it's quite disturbing. It wouldn't have happened if Jacob had followed God's command all the way back to Bethel and not settled in Shechem. And before we point a finger at Jacob, you and I struggle with partial obedience. Or sometimes we struggle with the intent to obey, but not what we like to call around here speedy obedience. Intent is honorable. Speedy obedience is what's right. On Thursday night at our MLM meeting, There was a phone call that came 10 minutes into our meeting. Gail got the call and whispered in my ear at the meeting, "It's your daughter, Melissa. It's about her car." The words that a parent, the dad of a single adult, does not want to hear on a Thursday night. I go to the phone, and Melissa announces, "Dad, I'm stuck on a hill." I thought, great, what do you want me to do? You know, you're stuck on a hill. Do you want me to give you some advice? Do you want me to leave the meeting and travel to Toronto and get you unstuck? Together we came up with a clever idea that she would be careful and reverse her way down on the other side and come off of that hill. Now, I did something. It was a teaching moment, Josh. It was a teaching moment. I said, "Now, Melissa, this past weekend when you were home, I seem to recall that I said to you, 'Have you got your snow tires on yet?'" And Melissa said, "Oh, yeah, it's coming. Well, she discovered the snow was coming, and on Thursday night. Now, just to be a man of integrity, Heather had been on to my case about a signal bulb in the van, and out of integrity, the very next morning or afternoon, I decided I better get that fixed or I'm not practicing what I preach. Let me park on this as we close. You're good people. I look out and I see some fine Christians. But maybe you're thinking, you know what, I'm doing pretty well. I've had some spiritual highlights. I love some of my encounters with God, and I'm working hard towards reconciliation with others. There's just this one area. There's just this one thing. And I intend to make it right. Like, I really do. Like next month, or 2019 is going to be my year. That's going to be the year where I'm going to be super Christian. Now is the time. Now is the day. We used to have that banner on the old gospel hall I attended in Orillia. Now is the time. Now is the time. Now is the day. Some of you playing that game with God like Jacob played. You think you're getting away with your partial obedience? You're not. You're putting yourself and your family and others in danger. This is the day to say, no more partial obedience, no more intent in the banner or the name of conflict resolution, even though I may be making progress there. I want to practice speedy obedience. I am convinced that there's something the Lord wants you to step out and trust and obey Him. I had a professor in seminary. It was a bit over the top, but if he saw you walking down a hallway, he'd stop you and say, "Okay, John, what area of obedience are you working on today?" Wow, that got you thinking. And you dare not say to him, "Well, I intend to make that right next week or next month." So we're going to ask you to stand, and Glenn and the team are going to lead us through an old hymn, but it's an oldie but a goodie. That hymn, Trust and Obey. And Glenn, when you're finished singing, a very quick prayer, and then we will do the doxology.